This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at recent FBI files showing that the Occupy movement was treated as a terrorist threat.
These people take us seriously, as they should, and they brought to bear every measure of a police state to crush our movement.
We'll talk about a lawsuit challenging the National Defense Authorization Act.
This one is amazing. It allows the military to pick up and detain forever American citizens in the United States for free speech activities.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, Happy New Year. It's good to see you again.
Well, Happy New Year to you, Heidi, and to you, Jeff, and to you, Michael Ratner, wherever you are.
Michael, I understand 8 former Army lieutenants have been charged in the killing of communist singer and songwriter Victor Jara. Now, this happened 4 decades ago.
It happened. It was the other 9/11. It happened on 9/11, 1973, in Chile. Of course, there was a democratically elected government in Chile. The head of the government was Salvador Allende. The head general, a constitutional officer, the head of the army in Chile, was a defender of democracy, was a general named René Schneider. And the United States played the pivotal role in overthrowing the government of Chile and the execution of Schneider and ultimately the execution of Victor Jara. And it happened this way. Henry Kissinger was President Nixon's Secretary of State at the time. Kissinger declared that no responsible people would allow their country to become socialist. In furtherance of Kissinger's policy of overthrowing this irresponsible people in Chile, they sent down machine guns with the serial numbers filed off and a lot of cash in diplomatic pouches. And this facilitated some elements in the army who wanted to overthrow the Allende government in kidnapping General Schneider. The notion was that they would kidnap Schneider and then blame it on the left. What happened, in fact, was Schneider was killed in the course of the kidnapping. The presidential palace was surrounded. Allende died. He was either murdered or committed suicide. But in any case, the government was overthrown. 25,000 people who defended democracy in Chile were rounded up and taken to the soccer stadium. One of them was Victor Jara. Victor Jara was singled out because he was a tremendously popular folk singer in Chile. He was taken by the military from the stadium, tortured. His hands were cut off. He was a guitar player. And he was murdered.
Michael, wasn't his body found a few days after filled with bullets?
Yes.
And also showing that he'd been tortured?
Yes. Yes, and his murderers were never caught. You know, in Chile, as in the United States, there's no statute of limitations on the crime of murder. Recently, these 8 military officers of the Chilean army were indicted by the new democratic Chilean government. After all these years, they're going to face justice. Heidi, you have a poem for us by Victor Jara, and I wonder whether you would share it with the audience.
I'll be happy to read it. I think it's also worth ending on the note that the murder of Jara essentially turned him into a symbol of the struggle against Latin Americans' military right-wing dictatorships.
Yeah, which proliferated throughout the subcontinent after the overthrow of Chile. The paradigm in Chile then spread to Central America. These right-wing death squads overthrew governments in a number of countries, including Nicaragua and El Salvador.
This is Victor Jara's last poem. It was written in a concentration camp, memorized, and, get this, smuggled out by other political prisoners by Victor Jara just before he was murdered. We are 5,000, confined in this little part of town. We are 5,000. How many of us are there throughout the country? Such a large portion of humanity, with hunger, cold, horror, and pain. 6 among us have already been lost and have joined the stars in the sky. 1 killed, another beaten, as I never imagined a human being could be beaten. The other 4 just wanted to put an end to their fears. 1 by jumping down to his death. the other smashing his head against a wall, but all of them looking straight into the eyes of death. We are 10,000 hands that can no longer work. How many of us are there throughout the country? The blood shed by our comrade president has more power than bombs and machine guns. With that same strength, our collective fist will strike again someday. Song, how imperfect you are! When I most need to sing, I cannot. I cannot because I am still alive. I cannot because I am dying. It terrifies me to find myself lost in infinite moments on which silence and shouts are the objectives of my song. What I now see, I have never seen. What I feel and what I have felt will make the moment spring again.
That was Victor Jara's last poem, moments before he was tortured and murdered by the Chilean military, supported by the United States government, on the other 9/11, 1973. Heidi, there's some new developments in the death penalty situation. Will you please share that with us?
It just so happens that in each of these states, reviews of capital punishment are currently underway. I think that as reviews in other states have proven recently and historically, the death penalty is not imposed in a consistent fashion. There is no fairness in its imposition. It's not a deterrent. And in fact, Michael, as you've mentioned to me, in many instances, when an execution takes place, spikes in local violence actually happen.
Yeah, it's actually an encouragement to violent crime. It doesn't deter it. Inevitably, in the cases that we've studied, the people that are sentenced to death are usually people of color and people who invariably have had terrible legal representation. I don't think in the history of the United States a millionaire has ever been executed.
No, and we know, unfortunately, that often the quality of the defense attorneys who represent prisoners on death row isn't really what it should be when a life hangs in the balance. Many times they're inexperienced. They certainly don't have the financial resources to conduct appropriate investigations.
Mistakes are made.
And the state has, in contrast, often limitless resources.
To punctuate what you've just said, when evidence is later produced of the innocence of the person condemned, the United States Supreme Court has held, in the opinion of Justice Scalia, that evidence of innocence is not relevant. Bill Kunstler used to say, proper word for this kind of position is decadence.
It's decadence. Since 1973, Michael, nearly 150 people have been freed from death row after exoneration through DNA evidence. And again, as we know, in many states, there just doesn't exist the money or the resources to conduct DNA testing. One only wonders if there were, and if it were, again, done on a consistent and fair basis, how many more individuals would be free. It's really an indictment on our criminal justice system, something to be ashamed of, and I think a hallmark of an uncivilized civilization.
Well, the United States is one of the few countries in the world that still retains the death penalty. China is another. I think Saudi Arabia is another. Let's hope that more and more people resolve in 2013 to get rid of it finally in the United States. Heidi, you recently had a holiday visit with Mumia Abu-Jamal in prison in Pennsylvania. Tell us what it was like.
I had a lovely holiday visit with Mumia, joined by Professor Johanna Fernandez, who drives me there every couple of months for our visit. Mumia was in great spirits, as usual. There was, in the large communal room where everyone is allowed to visit and have contact visits, in contrast to when we had to visit Mumia divided by thick plexiglass, there was a Christmas tree where you can have your photo taken with the inmate you're visiting. So we took a couple of snapshots with Mumia in front of the tree, had a lovely time. He's doing well. he's still, I think, you know, enjoying and slightly adjusting to the dramatic change from being in basically solitary confinement for 3 decades to now being able to interact with other inmates. He's working on a couple of writing projects, looked great. We talked from really the full gamut of sublime literary discussions to even more mundane things like what we all watch on television. So we had a lovely time.
You know, I saw the photograph of you and Johanna on the internet, and we should put it up on lawanddisorder.org, our website. It was just a Christmas present to see that photograph of the two of you with him.
It is. And, you know, you have to sort of collect your quarters. I may have mentioned this before. Put them into a machine. They issue you a little ticket, and then you're allowed to line up with others to have the photographer take a Polaroid shot. Then what we do is we bring it home, we scan it, and we share it. It's also worth noting for people who don't know that at the end of 2012, the Parisian suburb of Bobigny named a street after Mumia. And so this is the second street in France named after Mumia Abu-Jamal.
It should only happen in America.
A few weeks ago, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund released secret documents obtained by Freedom of Information Act requests, revealing that the Occupy movement was treated as a terrorist threat by the FBI. This, despite the agency's own acknowledgement that the organizers were engaged in peaceful protests. The documents show massive resources used to track the Occupy movement just a month prior to the encampment in New York's Zuccotti's Park. FBI and counterterrorism agents in offices across the country, from Anchorage to Jacksonville, Memphis, and Denver, coordinated with various local and federal law enforcement to monitor and collect intelligence on occupiers. The documents obtained by the partnership are heavily redacted and are just the tip of the iceberg, according to guest attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. We also talk with Mara about her thoughts on the state of civil rights for the year moving forward.
Mara, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm holding in my hand a copy of the Christmas Day edition of the New York Times. What a terrific present this was for all of us. The headline is, FBI Counterterrorism Agents Monitored Occupy Movement Records Show. And the lead sentence is as follows, dated in Washington. The Federal Bureau of Investigation used counterterrorism agents to investigate the Occupy Wall Street movement, including the communications and planning, according to newly disclosed agency records. You got those records.
Mara, before we talk about these specific records, I'd like to let our listeners sort of put this in context. For a while, I believe since the beginning of the Occupy movement, you and the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund have been asking for a lot of records. And leading up to this most recent development, what have you found?
In the fall of 2011, as we could all see this wave of crackdowns around the country against the Occupy movement happening, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund filed a series of Freedom of Information Act requests with federal agencies as well as with municipalities and police departments around the country. And we also filed them on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild and also on behalf of filmmaker author Michael Moore. And over the past year, we have really had to fight to get materials out, and the FBI produced materials to us in the eve of the Christmas holiday period, and we were really interested to suddenly get these materials and to see the depth and the breadth of the FBI's surveillance, monitoring, and focus on the Occupy movement. Prior to the FBI materials, we have obtained a lot of documents showing the Department of Homeland Security's involvement as well as other police, local police involvement around the country and other federal agencies.
How do corporations factor into this apparatus?
Yeah, that's just what I was going to ask you. That was amazing.
Well, that that's the thing about these documents that I think is very, very significant for many people looking at them. It does not come as a shock, I don't think, to the movement, to the people in the United States, and certainly with any historical perspective, that the FBI has continued unabated its historic role as basically the secret police in the United States, acting against the social justice movement in the United States, acting against people that, in the documents, the FBI itself acknowledges are part of a peaceful movement, a movement that does not advocate violence. And yet, throughout the documents, it shows the FBI, different joint terrorism task forces, different apparatuses around the country, using counterterrorism authority, using domestic terrorism authority, funding agents to focus on and go after this peaceful movement. But what the documents also show us is this very deep and close partnership that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security have with Wall Street and with the banks and businesses in the United States. The documents show the U.S. intelligence agencies and supposedly security agencies really working as the private intelligence arm for private businesses. So you have the people of the United States rising up in opposition to an economic crisis, an economic situation, of economic devastation caused by the banks and by Wall Street, and the U.S. government acting in partnership with the banks and Wall Street against those people.
And when you say in partnership, I assume you mean that they are exchanging data, photographs, intelligence, essentially, with each other, so that the private and the public sectors are gathering information and sharing it.
Yes, and I think it goes beyond that, beyond the information sharing. I mean, we're well aware of the FBI's constant use of, you know, massive data warehousing systems as sort of the choice point history of collecting large amounts of information and commercial information on the people of the United States and the government's absolute willingness to tap into that and access that information. But beyond that, these documents show, for example, the FBI was communicating with the New York Stock Exchange in August 2011 about the Occupy movement a month before the first tent was even set up in Zuccotti Park. It shows the FBI communicating with different businesses before the first protests began about the possibility of the protests, about who might be the focus of the protests. It then shows the FBI around the country with a really huge breadth geographically, working in partnership with private banks, with meetings where they sit down with the financial industry, with banks, and they're talking about peaceful protests. One of the documents we have involves the Domestic Security Alliance Council, where they are reporting on the planned port actions, the West Coast port actions of the Occupy movement. They are discussing the relationship between the Occupy movement and the labor movement. And the thing about the Domestic Security Alliance Council that's really noteworthy is it's a government agency that describes itself as a partnership between the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the private sector. So here's the acknowledgement of this entity that is a government entity, but yet completely an entity partnering with the private sector.
I recall the old quote from Karl Marx from 100-some years ago that the government is the executive committee of the ruling class. And sure enough, the documents that you've uncovered show that it's not just the executive committee, but the businesses and the government and the police are all working together. Here in New York, the New York City Police Department shares an office downtown with the police department and the Wall Street bankers. They share an office and they share information.
That a counterterrorism center.
Yeah. Not far from where we're broadcasting.
Right. The Lower Manhattan Security Initiative, and they label it with the security name, and yet they, all of the businesses and Brookfield Properties and Goldman Sachs all have desks in there sitting side by side with law enforcement. I think as you're saying it, it shows that we're not looking at something anomalous or aberrational. It's really sort of pulling back the cloak on what the U.S. government and its intelligence agencies and its quote-unquote terrorism authority is really doing and who it's partnering with. And it is against the people of the United States. It is not for the people of the United States.
Well, it is troubling, Mara, when we learn that law enforcement agencies in whose trust many of us put that their agenda may be guided by corporate interests, which of course is not for the people, but rather for the bottom line of the corporations.
It's very defining to show, I think, a level of police statism in the United States that is completely entwined with corporations, with, as Michael is saying, with the nature of capitalism in the United States, and what the role is of the government, of the police agencies, in really working to support an economic system, even in circumstances where the system is causing so much pain and so much suffering for people in the United States. And as people, you know, respond to that and try and organize for change in society peacefully and for a better way of life, those people and that movement is then treated by the government as a potentially criminal or terrorist threat. I think it helps us all really understand what the government means when it uses the terms of terrorism so broadly, and how it uses the authority and the money that it takes from the working people of the United States.
You know, to underscore that point, the New York Times article reported on one of the documents that you obtained, Mara, in Jacksonville, Florida, where the FBI was very concerned that the high rate of unemployment around the Jacksonville, Florida area would cause this movement to grow, and therefore they had to spy on it and repress it.
Yes, that's very, very noteworthy. It's really a political analysis coming from the FBI, acknowledging that areas of Daytona, Gainesville, the resident agency territories, they refer to those as being areas of some of the highest unemployment. Now, why are they presenting that kind of analysis? What would be criminal or terrorist about that? It's simply a recognition that the Occupy movement is a movement that, whether it's dominant or in the streets right now, exists, will continue to exist as an organic expression of where people are at and people's needs.
Mara, I want to read you a quote from an FBI spokesperson that appears in this Christmas Day article and ask you to comment on it. The quote is as follows. This is from an agent, a spokesperson for the FBI in Washington, and he says, "The FBI recognizes the rights of individuals and groups to engage in constitutionally protected activity. While the FBI is obligated to thoroughly investigate any serious allegations involving threats of violence, we do not open investigations based solely on First Amendment activity. In fact, the Department of Justice of the FBI's own internal guidelines on domestic operations specifically prohibit this." So that's the official position of the FBI.
Well, I don't know what is the official position of the FBI. It's plainly not the official position of the FBI. It's the official statement that the FBI's press people are going to read out loud when they are caught conducting actions that would appear to be illegal, unconstitutional, against the FBI guidelines and against the rights of the people of the United States. It's very plain in these materials that over and over again, the FBI itself is acknowledging that there is not a criminal threat, that there is not a threat of violence, and yet they are conducting operations on a completely lawful, protected free speech activities. And you can see it, and you can see it in the documents. I think we can be quite confident that if the FBI had materials that showed illegal and criminal activity, they would have been delighted to produce them and to make those public. And that's not an uncommon action for the FBI, given its routine willingness over the years to set people up and announce big terrorism arrests, you know, when there's almost always an FBI participant in those activities, if not organizing and leading those activities. These documents are heavily redacted. They've produced only about 100 pages, and we know there's a lot more out there, and we're fighting to get more. But I don't think that anyone can look at these documents and think that even on the face of them, there was any activity the FBI could have been legitimately conducting here.
Mara, one of the things that we've seen over the years, and you've certainly litigated this issue time and time again with great success, is a show of physical force on the streets by law enforcement coordinating with different levels of government, unlawful activities such as trap and arrest. And I think I read somewhere in the documents references to snipers. Do these documents include some of the tactics that were used as well?
The sniper reference is a reference in Houston, and there are references in these documents that the FBI had some information, some report, again, it's heavily redacted, of a supposed sniper threat or a threat against the demonstrators. Because they're so heavily redacted, it is difficult to get much information on it. The documents, though, do not look like the FBI, at least from what we can see, opened a terrorism investigation into that threat, which, if there was a threat, and again, we can't really see in the documents what that is, one would think that that would merit, supposedly, you know, the FBI's investigation, but that's not something we're seeing there.
Yeah, really?
That's such a good point, because I know in New York, when we had literally legions of police in riot gear encircling Union Square, when there were just very few Occupy Wall Street people present, the officers made it clear that was their priority, and they didn't really care if some unlawful activity was occurring a block away. All eyes were on Wall Street.
We know, again and again, I mean, the NYPD, you know, demonstrating in fine force over and over again, that they are acting like the political police. It is an effort to both disrupt and oppress the movement, but also to make peaceful protests look like it's criminal, to give that image to people, to people who might otherwise want to come out and join a demonstration, that the actions, which are completely lawful, peaceful, are cherished activities, have this imprimatur given them by the police as if they're criminal activities. And, you know, you look at the Brooklyn Bridge mass arrest, which the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has filed a class action challenging the constitutionality of that arrest. But it also sends a message to people. You want to come out and engage in lawful, peaceful activity, and you risk that arrest.
Well, one of the first things Ray Kelly did when he came to New York after 2001 was to make sure that some of the remaining protections of the so-called Hanshu consent decree were done away with. He went to court, insisted that law enforcement be offered increasing latitude to open investigations absent criminal activity or possibility of criminal activity of political speech.
Yes, and I think it bears pointing out that this FBI is President Obama's FBI and is Attorney General Eric Holder's FBI. And this is an FBI that acts as it has continued to act in its historic role from, you know, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the role of the FBI in acting as a secret police, as an element of police statism, of its efforts to shut down, disrupt, threaten, you know, the Black Liberation Movement, the anti-war movement, the progressive movement in the United States. And once again, when they feel the power of the people in the streets, the U.S. intelligence agencies and the quote-unquote law enforcement agencies go into high gear, because it is the movement of the people that really does cause change in society and cause the real change that can make a gigantic difference. And at these times, when it peaks like this, you can really see the truth of their operations.
We are speaking with Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, who is the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice. She's an attorney in Washington, D.C. The partnership has successfully gotten through a Freedom of Information Act request some documents showing how the FBI spied on the Occupy Wall Street movement. I wanted to talk about how they went into high gear after Occupy established itself and ask you this question, Mara. Isn't it true that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, in coordination with various local police departments, closed down the various Occupy sites, kind of in a coordinated move across the country on the same night?
Well, we certainly were able to see the coordinated nature of the crackdown in different municipalities. Different locations are under different jurisdictions. So the authority that would be used to shut down different encampments, of course, in most situations was under a, you know, state or municipal authority, in only a few limited circumstances but under explicitly federal authority. But in the materials we've obtained, there are coordinating calls that are taking place from the Conference of Mayors as well as with the Police Chiefs Associations. They are meeting routinely as soon as this movement has hit the ground, talking about how to deal with the movement, sharing information. And of course, in each of these instances, you know, the claim was always the site-specific emergency health and safety needs. But of course, the emergency health and safety needs seem to be repeated in different locations all over the country, regardless of efforts and proof, like in OWS in New York, that people cleaned the park, that it was in good shape, that it was not a threat. And we can see those discussions about really kind of using the health and safety language as a pretext to shut down encampments. What we're also able to see in a lot of the documents is a level of communication that's involving federal authorities, different federal agencies being part of those discussions.
Mara, I think for listeners who may not be aware, the use of pretextual shutdowns, and we've certainly seen this in D.C. related to national special security events where police go in and raid, for example, an organizer's headquarters or the puppet-making warehouse, saying that there's fire code violation or something. Those pretextual shutdowns have what we call a chilling effect on free speech, and they're improper.
They are improper. It is illegal to use administrative raids as a pretext for other interests. And that is across the board, both in the constitutional context, where it would be very heightened, as well as just in other circumstances, that the police can't use the pretext of an administrative raid to conduct what would otherwise be an unlawful search in a criminal context. But certainly when you have people organizing, and we litigated that case in April 2000 in Washington, D.C., when the police, the fire department, and, as our documents later showed, the FBI, participated in a pretextual raid to shut down the organizing center, the convergence center, of people planning demonstrations against the IMF and the World Bank. It is an element of the playbook that's used routinely, and I think was used again here in open-air spaces.
Mara, you've said that these documents represent just the tip of the iceberg. Can you expand on that briefly?
The breadth of what we have is very interesting because it shows the geographic scope. And at the very same time, this is only about 100 pages of materials. And when you look at each page, almost every single page itself is referencing meetings, discussions, reports, intelligence gathering, other references that undoubtedly exist in other documentary form. And we know that they have not given us the entire breadth of what they have. And even on the pages themselves, they are heavily redacted. So we're appealing both redactions as well as the scope of production and scope of search.
Mara, does the Partnership for Civil Justice have a website? And are these documents that you've so far obtained available for our listeners?
Indeed, and we would really like people to come and read the documents and communicate back with us, filling in the blanks, too, because the people who are on the ground know what was really happening on a day-to-day basis. If you go to justiceonline.org, that's all one word, justiceonline.org, you can click through and see the FBI documents. They are in a searchable format up on that site. We have had tens of thousands of visitors coming through reading those documents from all around the world. And we want people to see them, too, because it's critical that the people of the United States, in particular, are able to have that window into what the government of the United States is doing. We've also put up on our website, also searchable, the documents from Homeland Security and the Park Service and the police agencies. And as we get material, we're continuing to make it available. So you can sign up on our website so that you get the breaking news alerts as soon as we get more documents. So definitely justiceonline.org.
Since it's the beginning of the new year, we'd like to ask you if you could share your concerns about what we face politically in the next 12 months.
The concerns, in a way, are, I would say, almost the same in my perspective as they kind of are year to year. And the concerns are also based at the same time on a great optimism in terms of the people of the United States and our ability to create justice for ourselves. You have that history and that fact, and you have the Occupy movement, and you have people knowing and feeling their right and their power to organize and to speak out. At the same time, the concerns stem then from the government's deep, deep recognition of that, just like the document that you were referencing before, where in Florida they're looking at the rates of unemployment and thinking that that's a spark for social justice action. You know, you have the reauthorized FISA amendments where you have the Obama administration basically saying that they feel the Fourth Amendment is an interference with police action. Well, indeed, it should be. It is the protection against the people. And the wholesale nature of the government's decision to surveil and disrupt the people of the United States requires the people of the United States to push back. We've done that before. That happened in the 70s with the Church Committee hearings. That's a time that's come once again for people to organize, to expose the government action, and to end this kind of operation because we can do it.
Mara, I agree. Michael agrees. We're nodding our heads with the paradigm of so-called perpetual war that our leaders have put forth. Do you still think that a strong people's movement is able to counter that, given in the past the wars were more cyclical? But like the Cold War, there's a propaganda being put forth that threatens to make permanent this fear of an unidentifiable, almost amorphous, an all-consuming enemy.
We will always face challenges. People and fight for liberation have always faced the challenge of the moment, where at the moment you're surrounded by, you know, what looks like an impenetrable force. And yet, think about how dark it looked for the civil rights movement at points, you know, certainly through the long history up into the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And then because of the resistance and the resilience and the fighting spirit of people who were not going to sit down and take it and who were going to organize and fight and fight and fight, that changed. It changed completely. That's how change is always made. You know, on the horizon, you have to be able to see forward that, in fact, you can accomplish those goals. And then those goals become accomplished, because when you're fighting for something that's true and you're fighting for something that's just, and in fact you have the weight of that on your side, and that outcome becomes not just a possibility but the reality.
That was so beautifully said, Mara. Thank you. That should be our collective New Year's resolution. Mara Verheyden Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice, justiceonline.org. You do great work, Mara. Our regards to you and to Carl and your whole organization. And thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Happy New Year, Mara.
Happy New Year.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for
There's a
Japan.
Section of the National Defense Authorization Act of last year, 2012, which allows the American military to pick up an American citizen in the United States and hold them indefinitely on allegations of being associated very vaguely with terrorist forces. A lawsuit was brought to enjoin the government and the military from carrying out this law, and it was successful. Back in September, Judge Catherine Forrest ruled on behalf of six plaintiffs, which included Daniel Ellsberg, the famous whistleblower, Noam Chomsky, and Chris Hedges, and three others, and granted them first a temporary injunction, and then in September a permanent injunction, in essence wiping this law off the books, telling the military this is a gross violation of 200 years of American constitutional law, and you can't do this. That decision is being appealed by the Obama administration with its Republican allies. It's here at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York. It's going straight to the Supreme Court, a major turn in the rights of American citizens soon to be decided. We talked with one of the attorneys for Chomsky, Ellsberg, Hedges et al., Carl Mayer, who successfully argued the case.
Welcome, Carl, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you, Heidi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, we've been following with interest the lawsuit against the NDAA, and we're very happy that you did have one positive development, and that was the decision of Judge Catherine Forrest. Can you tell us what happened and where you're going from there?
Sure. Well, actually, we had two positive developments, which was back in May, we obtained a preliminary injunction from Judge Forrest, who preliminarily enjoined the NDAA, which some people call the Homeland Battlefield Act, because it
treats
the United States as a battlefield and allows the military to exercise power over civilians, which is something that's antithetical to our democracy and to 200 years of constitutional precedent. So in May of last year, of 2012, after a trial before Judge Catherine Forrest, who's a federal judge in the Southern District of New York, we achieved a preliminary injunction. That was then appealed, but the appeal would stay pending a trial on a permanent injunction. And on September 12th, Judge Forrest issued a permanent injunction against the NDAA.
And let's just tell listeners what that means. An injunction basically means it's temporarily stopped.
The preliminary injunction meant it was temporarily stopped. So it was stopped as a matter of law between May 16th and September 12th, which we thought was a terrific achievement. But then the judge actually issued an order granting a permanent injunction on September 12th, and that permanently stopped the NDAA. However, once that happened, the Obama administration went into overdrive and immediately appealed that to the Second Circuit and asked for a stay of Judge Forrest's order pending appeal, which they obtained. And that stay lifted Judge Forrest's injunction, so unfortunately, the NDAA of 2012 now operates. Although, in their papers, the government promised that our clients would not be touched under the NDAA, and they seemed to imply that no one in their position would be touched under the NDAA.
Let's back up for a moment, Carl, and talk about what might happen and what your clients, Noam Chomsky was one, Chris Hedges was another. They were afraid that because of their journalistic activity that they would be cited for providing aid to terrorism. What were their fears? Expand on that. What were your arguments? And, what's at stake here? Because we're talking about American citizens being picked up in the United States by the American military for their speech activities.
Right. Well, as Judge Forrest herself said in her opinion on the permanent injunction, which is a terrific 112-page opinion, it's available at stopndaa.org.
Say that again.
It's stopndaa.org. People can go and read all the documents from the case, actually. But in her opinion, Judge Forrest said the stakes could not be any higher. And the core of what she meant is that this is a civil liberties challenge, and it's a First Amendment challenge. And what's at stake is the liberty and the right to free speech of all journalists and all activists, and indeed any citizen in the United States of America, because the military has never had the power to detain civilians. The only exception to that was during World War II with the Korematsu case, which is when some Japanese Americans were interned in prison camps.
A disgrace that has been recognized as such to date.
Correct. It is a disgrace. Even Justice Scalia recognizes that as a stain on our judicial history. We were honored, actually, in the Second Circuit Court of Appeal to have the descendants of Korematsu and the other lead plaintiffs in that case file an amicus brief in our case in Hedges versus Obama. And I think that sort of suggests how important this fight is, because everyone's civil liberties are endangered. And what Judge Forrest ruled, in essence, was that this law, the NDAA, is so vague that it doesn't pass constitutional review. It is a violation of the First Amendment, because the law says, in essence, that anyone who, quote, substantially supports Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or, quote, associated forces can be covered under the NDAA, which permits the U.S. military to pick up anyone and place them in military and detain them in a military prison until, quote, the end of hostilities, which could be forever. And there's no right to a civilian trial by jury. There's no right to an attorney. This is an authoritarian measure that really smacks of the internments of World War II. It's really something that's unprecedented.
Carl, give us an example of how a journalist could be construed to provide substantial support.
And associate forces, those two things are scary.
Right. Could it be just writing an opinion piece that expresses what the government could see as intellectual support or ideological support?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. And this point was made abundantly clear during the trial and before Judge Forrest. In fact, Judge Forrest repeatedly asked the representatives of the government at the time whether they could offer assurances to the plaintiffs, who are all journalists and activists, like Chris Hedges, formerly of the New York Times, like Daniel Ellsberg, like Noam Chomsky. And Judge Forrest repeatedly asked government attorneys whether she could give them assurances that they would not be subject to detention or military trial under this act. Repeatedly, the government declined to do so.
Could this apply to co-hosts of a radio show?
You bet.
I'll bake you a cake.
I would, yes. I would venture to guess that some of your hosts or co-hosts might be on some list somewhere. But yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we went through several rounds of questioning at trial. Chris Hedges, for example, is a correspondent for many years that covered not only Al-Qaeda, but 17 other groups that are on the State Department terrorism list of terrorist organizations. And so he testified at trial that he believed that the NDAA, he had a reasonable fear that the NDAA could put him in jeopardy. The judge found his testimony credible. He indicated he had a fear not just because of his reporting, but because he does opinion pieces all the time on issues relating to the Middle East and to some of these groups. He's interviewed, you know, members of PLO or Hamas. Who is to say that they're not considered, quote, associated forces under the statute? I mean, you know, as attorneys, what's incredible about this law is there is no definitional section. I have not encountered another statute in practice in 25 years that has absolutely no definitional section. It doesn't define what associated forces are. It doesn't define what substantially supported means. You know, Hedges testified at trial. He had been detained a couple of times by the military for leaving the press pool in Iraq. Now, of course, this is before the NDAA. But the NDAA gives all sorts of, you know, he was detained for a short period of time. But now the NDAA allows these detentions, quote, until the end of hostilities. It's completely open-ended. It really is a heinous statute. And,
well, without a definition section, doesn't that render it constitutionally vague?
Correct, and that's what Judge Forrest ruled. And that's what we'll be arguing to the Second Circuit shortly. It is right now the appeal was put on an expedited basis, so we lost the stay, but we got an expedited appeal. The briefing is complete, and we're waiting for an oral argument date. We anticipate that date will be sometime in the next month. In the interim, we have put in motions to the Supreme Court asking them to lift the stay. Unfortunately, Judge Ginsburg denied that motion, citing the expedited appeal. We have one before Justice Scalia now. You know, I imagine that we might not prevail on that, but we hope that this appeal will be heard quickly because we think we have the better of the argument, and we think the record below is very solid. One of the things about this case that's astounding is even though the administration has been aggressively pursuing this case to defend the NDAA along with their Republican brethren, and even though they have they put a fast track on the appeal, they didn't put in any witnesses or affidavits at the trial level. No one to explain what these terms like substantially supported or associated forces or anything of that order would mean. So it's just it's completely vague. That's why Judge Forrest ruled in favor of the plaintiffs here. Just add one other point, which I think is relevant to the show that you just had about these recent documents showing that the FBI and other law enforcement considered Occupy Wall Street to be subject to scrutiny as possibly terrorist groups. Several of our plaintiffs in this case are young activists affiliated with Occupy Wall Street. For example, one of the plaintiffs in our case is Kai Wargala, who founded Occupy London. And Occupy London found themselves on a list of terrorist organizations right next to Al-Qaeda that was put out by the City of London. And this shows how this is going on worldwide, but particularly in the United States. You have the targeting of civilian dissent as being a terrorist enterprise. And you have, you know, everything that comes as dissent these days is branded terrorism. It's eco-terrorism. It's terrorism that financial terrorism. And it's all under the rubric of stifling dissent. But what this NDAA does is it opens up a whole new chapter, which is to allow the military to directly detain these folks. So that's why we're fighting.
Carl, I wonder if the government's failure to produce witnesses at trial to give more information is because they want to shroud this in sort of national security secrecy that we've seen so often before in court proceedings.
That's correct. The government they have basically two moves. They're not very imaginative. They say that whoever brings the suit has no standing. And then they say, if it gets past that point, they say, oh, well, sorry, the state secrets doesn't allow you to have any discovery here. And I think basically they just believe that that the plaintiffs here wouldn't be construed as having standing, but the court found otherwise, and it was fortunate that they did.
We're speaking with attorney Carl Mayer, who's the attorney for Daniel Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and three other people, litigating in the federal court system, about to go to the Court of Appeals and then the Supreme Court on the question of whether the United States military can pick up American citizens in the United States for essentially free speech activities of association and discussion. Your client, Chris Hedges, wrote a recent opinion online where he speculated that the reason that the government wants to give the military this kind of power is that because they fear that the economic crisis, which will probably get worse, and the climate crisis, which is certainly going to get worse, are going to cause massive civilian discontent, and that Chris speculates that government doesn't trust the local police departments anymore, that they'd like to have an army available to crush that upsurge that they anticipate that's going to be coming. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, Chris has a way of stating things boldly and dramatically, for which I respect him. He may be right. It's hard to tell whether the economic and ecological crisis will turn that grave and in what period of time. But I will say that no matter what happens in the future, for the last 10 years, there is no question that our society has fundamentally changed. I don't recognize any longer the country of my birth. This is the greatest assault on civil liberties since the McCarthy period. You know, last year, for example, there were 106 applications put in by federal, state, and local law enforcement for drones that would be used within the United States of America. You know, the applications were put into the FAA for a drone airspace. So drones are here in this country. That was in addition to the warrantless wiretapping surveillance that's been going on at least since 9/11 and maybe earlier. That's in addition to the Patriot Act, which subjects Americans' private records or the records that they use seeking out information in libraries, et cetera, can be subject to government scrutiny. I never thought growing up in this country that you'd see police officers in the streets dressed in paramilitary garb. It now looks, it's very hard to distinguish often between the military and the police in cities, especially during some of these recent protests. So, you know, all of these things are of a piece. And more the executive branch is asserting an inviolate right to do this. Even beyond the scrutiny of courts. You recall that in defending the president's program of targeted assassinations, even of American citizens, Attorney General Holder stated that Americans are entitled to due process, but that doesn't necessarily mean judicial process. Which is an incredible statement. It essentially takes the view that during, quote, wartime, that the judiciary has no role to play and that the executive gives, you know, sort of as a noblesse oblige, the executive gives whatever rights it feels like giving to American citizens. Chris stated his view rather starkly, but I have no doubt that this latest legislation, the NDAA, is sort of the culmination of 10 years of anti-civil liberties measures and is edging our country towards authoritarianism. That's why I think the fight to stop all of these measures is so important, and why what the Guild does is so important, what Michael Ratner's Center for Constitutional Rights does is so important. When we're in tough economic times, people don't tend to focus on these sort of esoteric areas, but I think more and more Americans are awakening to the fact that their civil liberties are gravely in danger.
Carl, that's beautifully put, and I think really frames where we're thinking of going forward as we start the new year.
We want to remind our listeners they can plug into what Carl's been talking about on stopndaa.org. Carl, we wish you every success in your oral arguments in the Court of Appeals. We want you to please come back on Law and Disorder and report on how it went. And you know you have our infinite gratitude and our solidarity, and we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Not at all. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm a big fan, and I did my first radio interview with WBAI back in 1985 when I wrote a book on public land. So I've always
been a
WBAI fan.
What's the name of your book?
It's called Public Domain, Private Dominion. It's about how companies exploit the public lands for private benefit.
Oh, how appropriate.
I'm shocked.
Thank you. We'll look forward to reading that.
Thanks, Carl. We'll talk to you again soon, and good luck.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Anytime. Appreciate it.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.